August the 8th, Friday, 77 degrees, going up to 89 today, and the heat, while terrible, has not been brutal, let's put it that way. A 40% chance for showers through the weekend, and I don't see anything up and through next Saturday that would be over 90 degrees for a high, which is good. The humidity is still going to be ridiculous, and the tropics are quiet for the next 7 days, so we'll take it. That's all we can do at this time in hurricane season. Prashant Yadav joins us now, healthcare supply chain expert at the Council on Foreign Relations, to talk about pharmaceutical tariffs. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm well, Tommy. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for taking the time. Let's talk about what President Trump has proposed with an idea toward what?
So we have to acknowledge that the United States has a high degree of dependency on multiple pharmaceutical products that come largely imported from India, China, other countries in the world. And some of these are critical medicines. Our healthcare system, our hospitals, clinics, and patients depend critically on these medicines. And in case there is any shortage, which could be due to geopolitical events or trade embargoes or anything of that nature, can hamper the healthcare system's resilience, its ability to maintain continuity of care. So the idea is to make sure that we use the right policy instruments to bring back more manufacturing of critical medicines to the U.S., or at least to diversify it to come from multiple countries instead of being over-dependent on, let's say, China or India.
Are we, in your opinion, over-dependent right now on China and India?
For certain categories of medicines, yes, we are. One example is heparin, which is a blood thinner that I would say about a few million Americans take routinely for either chronic conditions or when they're going through a cardiovascular or the procedure as an IV. And there our dependence is very high on China as the supplier of the active ingredient, even though there are multiple manufacturers, including some in the United States, that make the finished product. But the active ingredient that goes into the finished product comes about 90 or 95% from China to these manufacturers. So that's one example. Amoxicillin, which is a staple for pediatric practices around the country, or many other antibiotics, the same issue repeats. We have either a very few select manufacturers in India or China, or even if we have a finished product manufacturer in the U.S., it gets all of its input in materials and ingredients from China. So the examples are very many, but we have a high degree of dependence on select critical medicines. That doesn't mean we have it on all the medicines. The higher-end medicines, so for example, cell and gene therapy, new modalities of treatment, such as mRNA treatments, those are things, and higher-end biologics, cancer care, those are things that are made domestically in the U.S. They have been developed here, but more traditional and established medicines, generics, but also on-patent products that have been around for more than 10 years. Those are the ones where we have a higher degree of dependency on imports.
Does it skew more toward those that are generic than are under patent?
Yes. So more of the generic medicines are imported from India and China, the reason being that the margins on these are very thin. And as a result, the cost of production becomes an important consideration in deciding where to source product from. So generic medicines are the ones where the dependency is much, much higher. But that doesn't mean it's only generic medicines. There are other products which are made, if not in India and China, let's say they're made in Europe, in Ireland, in Switzerland, and the U.S. imports them from those countries. And sometimes the reasons are for tax optimization. Sometimes the reasons are because the companies had set up a large plant in Europe, and instead of fragmenting their manufacturing network and having more than one factory, they want to keep supplying from a single factory because it helps them reduce costs in some ways.
So,
but to answer your question bluntly, yes, it is largely generic medicines.
So when it comes to these weight loss medications that so many people rely on, I'm a little bit confused because I know they have brand names, but I know there are people that provide these medications that are not the brand names. They are getting those from China. How does that work with other countries and patents medications, weight loss drugs, et cetera?
So for weight loss drugs, we have two that are authorized at the moment. One is a drug made by Eli Lilly and Company, and the other is made by Novo Nordisk. The drug from Novo Nordisk is manufactured to a larger extent in Europe. The drug from Eli Lilly is manufactured to a greater degree, or if not fully, in the U.S. But because the total supply has not been that high historically, many compounding pharmacies in the U.S. have started buying the active ingredient for these products and compounding them, essentially filling them into small vials that patients use. So it's become a market which consists of two manufacturers with production sites that are located, in one case, Novo Nordisk, more in Europe, Eli Lilly, more in the U.S., and then a number of compounding groups and pharmacies that have evolved. Now, as the total capacity from the original manufacturers, Lilly and Novo Nordisk, starts to expand, the role of the compounding pharmacies starts getting diluted because we may not need them. The manufacturers themselves can fulfill the demand. So that's the juncture at which the anti-obesity and the weight loss drug market is at currently.
I know you wrote a paper on tariffs, so we're going to talk about that in a second, but quickly to revisit these weight loss drugs for a second. So if it's a patent medication, how can a compounding pharmacy know what the recipe is?
So if it's a patented medicine, the company owns the patent to produce it, but in case there is a shortage of supply, which means the company cannot fulfill its entire demand in the country, we allow compounding pharmacies to manufacture. And when I say manufacture, I'm essentially talking about taking an active ingredient and filling it into a vial or into a capsule in some cases. That is legal, and that's what is happening for the obesity drugs. Now, there are lots of nuances in how the intellectual property plays out in such a scenario. Mm-hmm. How much royalties paid to the company? Do the companies authorize such a mechanism? I think that's a much more complex space, which requires a lot of nuance of intellectual property legislation.
I just wonder generally, so it's a patent medication, but the formula is available for compounding pharmacies if needed. Would that be accurate? Okay, let me take a break. We'll come back, talk about your paper on tariffs. Prashant Yadav is our guest, healthcare supply chain expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. We'll talk about President Trump's proposed tariffs on imported drugs. 621 traffic now, WWL. Tommy Tucker, WWL, 626 and a half, talking to Prashant Yadav, healthcare supply chain expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. I know you wrote a 12-page letter on blanket tariffs on pharmaceutical imports. I could rumble and fumble and stumble my way through it, Prashant, but I think it's best just to let you give us maybe the overview and walk us through it.
So we want to start by saying that there is generally a problem in America's pharmaceutical supply chain, which is a high, extremely high in some cases, degree of dependence on China and in some cases companies in India. That problem is a national security risk. It is a health system resilience risk and needs to be addressed. We highlight examples, you know, in the periods when we, after 9/11, we had the anthrax attacks. We had to rely on ciprofloxacin, something which we considered to be a medicine of critical national security importance at that time. We remind people that today, a large portion of the supply of ciprofloxacin, that sort of key antibiotic we needed for anthrax, is now coming from India and China, and the active pharmaceutical ingredient of that is coming from China. So we do need some kind of policy action. But then we go into looking at, does a policy instrument that consists of blanket tariffs on all pharmaceuticals solve the problem? Or does it, in fact, create additional unintended consequences, such as will it create shortages of key generic medicines, where we've already had shortages many times in the past? These include injectable chemotherapy agents, other injectable generics that are sort of main staple use in a hospital setting. So I think our...
Are you talking about saline solution and things like that, Prashant?
Not just saline solution. Saline solution could be one of those, but also things such as, you know, injectable chemotherapy would be the best example of this. We've had multiple shortages. It comes from a few companies in India and China. So I think our key ask is we ought to solve this problem of high degree of dependence. It's important for national security. It's important for health system readiness. It's important for ensuring the quality of medicines that every American gets. But we've got to look at this with a range of policy instruments, not just tariffs. We need to think about what will incentivize a large global company to set up a generic manufacturing plant or other medicines manufacturing plant in the U.S. over the locations that they choose by themselves. When left to its own devices, the supply chain chooses locations that are best from a tax standpoint, that are best from an environmental compliance standpoint, that are best from capital investment standpoint. We've got to change that equation so that companies feel, oh, if I set up my new factory in Louisiana or in North Carolina, I'm going to be at least at par with what it would mean to set it up in another location in India or China or Europe or Ireland. So that's going to require a number of different policy instruments, government giving concessional loans, government gearing up the federal purchasing, whether it is for the VA system or for other government purchasing, DOD, making sure that it buys from a new company that sets up a plant in the United States. And that demand side needs to be addressed. Just tariffs alone, essentially, it's creating unpredictability for the companies to say, should I move my location to the U.S.? If I move it, what will be the implications? And doesn't necessarily create a strong and compelling business case for a company to move location, in particular for generic companies. Now, we have to admit that many companies in the last few months have announced large investments, both in manufacturing and in clinical development in the U.S. After the inauguration of President Trump. And these amount to hundreds of billions of dollars of new investment. But once again, we've got to keep in mind that this new investment that has been announced is largely coming into areas which are the high-end therapeutics, cell and gene therapy, advanced biologics, which are important. But these are areas where we don't have as high a degree of import dependence on India and China.
Thank you, Prashant. I appreciate your time and your insight. Prashant Yadav, Healthcare Supply Chain Expert, Council on Foreign Relations. It's a Rubik's Cube. We'll talk more when we come back. 6:31, 29 till 7. Time now, WWL First News. 6:46, 14 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL. I was out playing tennis with Grady yesterday, and the mosquitoes drove me inside as well as the gnats. As a matter of fact, when I left today, he was sitting there looking at me like, and I don't know if your dogs have ever done this. They're looking at you like they can't wait for you to leave so they can get on the phone and start inviting friends over. Maybe I'm wrong. Aaron Ashbrook joins us now, assistant professor of urban, peri-urban entomology at LSU. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Morning, Tommy. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm okay. Thanks for taking the time. Before we get to mosquitoes, man, you know, you're out there in the grass playing with the dog, doing whatever. I don't know if it's gnats or what it is, and I did notice, if you step back and look in the light, you know, with the filter and all that stuff, you can see these little white things flying around. Are those gnats? What are those?
Yeah, so we did have a lot of small gnats, these little space fly gnats that kind of basically they're really a kind of an annoyance. They fly in your face, they get in your nose, they get in your ears. They don't really want to bite you or do anything outside of just get on you. Mm-hmm. So we did have quite a bad year for those small little flies that like to fly up in your face.
Well, something's biting me on the legs. I know that. I don't know what it is because, man, I'm scratching like you don't know what after I'm out there playing in the grass with the dogs. So is it gnats or I don't think it's mosquitoes or what do you think?
So we did have some mosquitoes as well. So I wasn't sure if you were referring to some of the other small flies that we have within the state, but of course we do have plenty of mosquitoes that will bite as well.
I don't know what it was, but it didn't seem like mosquitoes, but man, I was had like 1,000 bites all over my legs that I was scratching, but not the point. Let's talk about mosquitoes. Are they getting worse in Louisiana?
So we do have some West Nile virus issues within the state. I would say as far as supporting mosquito control, I believe we are doing pretty good. Those agencies are doing pretty well in managing our mosquitoes. This year, some of the records I saw is that even though we do have some activity for West Nile virus this year, the overall threshold is lower than what we've had last year. And that's due to some of the work by these mosquito control districts, like those at St. Tammany Parish, you know, those in New Orleans, et cetera.
Does West Nile equal a decrease in less Nile equal a decrease in mosquitoes, or not necessarily?
So not necessarily. That's a really good question that you asked, Tommy. Essentially, what these districts are looking for is frequencies of infection within mosquito populations as well as animal populations. Mm-hmm. And so you could, in theory, see a decrease in West Nile virus activity and still have high mosquito populations.
So let me ask you a dumb question. I don't know if you know the answer or not, but when you see all the cattle in the fields and so forth as you drive by, I would presume the mosquitoes are just going to town on them, or not, because maybe their hide's too thick. What about that?
Yeah, it's a good question, and so you're right. They do. The mosquitoes do go for those cattle that you'll see out there on the highway. Some mosquitoes, some of the more nuisance-type mosquitoes, can be really bad for the cattle, like the salt marsh mosquitoes. They can be very bad for some of these cattle out in the more plains-type environments within the state. So not necessarily involved with disease transmission. However, those mosquitoes can be very problematic for our livestock.
Yeah, it would just seem like if I'm a cow and I'm standing out there, other than my tail, you know, which I can use to swat stuff away within that radius, it would seem like I'd be covered with mosquitoes because they can just suck as much blood out of me until I'm dry. Am I making stuff up?
Yeah, no, I've heard of that before.
Really?
I have heard of cattle being exsanguinated by mosquitoes. I don't know if it was a true report or not, but I have heard of it happening before.
Wow.
Within the state.
Every now and then, a squirrel that can't see finds a nut, right? 6:50, 10 till 7, we're going to talk about preventing mosquitoes when we come back. I'm going to tell you all what, real quick before we go, I'm going to tell you something about 5-gallon buckets that you probably may not have realized when we return. 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:55 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Aaron Ashbrook on this Friday morning, assistant professor of peri-urban entomology, about mosquitoes and why they're so bad. Even a bottle cap of water can lead to breeding grounds for mosquitoes. And what I was saying about the buckets earlier, Aaron, is I'm a 5-gallon bucket guy. I just like to put stuff in buckets, right? But I realized flipping these buckets over to keep the rain out and keep them from collecting water, there are numerous sections, if you will, partitions and on the bottom of these buckets that people don't realize they're not smooth, that could collect water and still create breeding grounds for mosquitoes.
That's correct. Any small container that can hold just a few milliliters of water, just enough for larval mosquitoes to be in there and grow and develop, as well as to maintain algae for them to feed upon, that is good enough for them to grow in, you know. I also have a tendency to find mosquito larvae in the saucers of my potted plants, just holding just a little bit of water, and they're down there breeding.
That's why you should never have potted plants. You should always have concrete. But along those lines, when it comes to people having stuff outdoors and it raining every afternoon, I don't know how you keep up with that. Thoughts?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say if you can, bring some of those items indoors. Maybe you could set them up in such a way that they drain more readily. You know, I kind of have a lot of my thing, a lot of my porch items kind of bought back. And then when I want to bring them out, I then will pull them off the patio. And so that way they're not collecting as much water, but it's a constant battle.
What is the role of weather play in this? What happens when it gets extremely hot, when it gets cold? I don't recall seeing any mosquitoes when it snowed, but I don't know if that's just because of the seasonal thing. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. So essentially, mosquito activity is weather-driven to the point where we can even talk about what are referred to as mosquito days, where essentially these are days where the temperature and humidity are ideal for mosquitoes and their development. So as temperatures increase, mosquitoes actually will grow faster, so it accelerates their development time. And so, of course, in Louisiana, when it gets hot, that's something that we're encountering. And, of course, the rain Mosquitoes, their larvae, they need water to survive and develop into adults. And so when we have a lot of rain, that also creates conditions that are good for breeding. So we not only accelerate their development, but we have placed a lot of locations where mosquitoes can breed.
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but by my perception is it's been a rainy summer, and I'm just wondering, are we winning or are the mosquitoes winning? Is it getting worse?
Well, you know, it's the good work of our mosquito control districts that are keeping our mosquitoes at bay, and I would say that we are winning the battle as much as we can.
What would you tell people to do to protect themselves from mosquitoes?
Yeah, that's another great question. So I kid you not, Tommy, when I go out in the woods, I bring heavy DEET with me, or the DEET heavy woods, because, you know, you apply it, it works for a while. Mm-hmm. It seems to go away, whether it's getting washed off by water, humidity, sweat. And so then you start getting bit by mosquitoes again. So I always carry the repellent with me and then reapply it as I need. You can wear loose-fitting clothes, and that also helps protect you a little bit in that mosquitoes they're easier to bite you if you're wearing tight-fitting clothes. They can kind of penetrate through those fibers. And there are a variety of repellents that are available. You just want to make sure that you're using one that's approved by the EPA because they actually test it and make sure that it works.
Aaron, if I can leave you with two thoughts, and I would never pretend to give a professor advice, but they would be get rid of the potted plants and go with concrete and stay out of the woods, stay indoors.
Hey, I like it. Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron Ashbrook. I appreciate your time and your insight as always. Assistant Professor of Urban Peri-Urban Entomology at LSU. We're talking about vaping. When we come back, you think it's better than smoking. Might be a little bit better, but not a whole lot better. We'll talk about that when we return on WWL. 7:15 now, according to the talk and text line here, a lot of people loving Monty Python. I just don't get it for whatever reason. Dr. Corey Hebert joins us, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. How you doing, Dr. Corey?
I'm good. Good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. Monty Python makes you laugh or not? Are you a big fan?
It makes me chuckle.
Okay.
Chuckling is okay.
Chuckling's fine. Okay, sure, absolutely. But you're saying not a full-blown guffaw.
No.
Not a guffaw.
And I like goofy humor, so yeah. You know, it's just not my cup of tea.
But a chuckle.
I will chuckle.
You know,
it's goofy.
I think now that you mention it, I think that's a good way to put it. Maybe that's the way I feel about it. I'll chuckle, but I won't guffaw.
There you go.
All right.
I won't slap my knee, that's for sure.
Oh,
I might
certainly
slap
no knee slapper. No, absolutely.
Yeah, but I might slap the body, but not my knee.
So no
sure.
Knee slapper. And let's talk about vaping, because a lot of people think. Have you tied the knot yet, by the way, or not?
I have not, but very soon.
Okay.
Very soon.
And I'll try to make this quick, because I know you probably, you know, just hit your drive and you're waiting to hit your 7-iron, and the group behind you is waiting. So let's talk about... Let's talk about vaping, and seriously, though, about what do we know now that we didn't know when these things first came out?
Yeah, well, I just want people to recognize that anytime you incinerate something and it goes into your lungs, it's bad. Mm. It doesn't matter if you're burning leaves, it doesn't matter if you're burning tobacco, it doesn't matter if you're burning marijuana. It is bad for your lungs, right? But this vaping thing adds a new little piece to it, because when you vape, it's an electric coil that's in the chamber of this vape. So it ignites the electric coil, which also has these heavy metals in them, right? So when you inhale that, you inhale whatever you're inhaling in the vape, which is either some type of nicotine, some type of marijuana, or whatever, which is not regulated by the FDA in any way. So it could also have fentanyl or any other chemical that can kill you, or drug that can kill you, but it also has all of these heavy metals, and we've seen that, you know, the nickel, the chromium, the cadmium, the lead, all these things are going into your lungs, and that's a bad thing, but they're also going into your bloodstream, and they can be toxic to you, neurotoxic, as well as carcinogenic and causing cancer. So, you know, just for full transparency, we are seeing a slight decrease in the vaping among teens. Mm-hmm. It was a huge decrease in the last 2 years, but now we've seen that start to pick up a little bit. And we think some of the reasons that we're seeing that is because We have a lot of the flavored vapes now, so they have all these flavors like strawberry and grape and that kind of thing, so it's kind of enticing the children. But we're also seeing the fact that these vapes are coming in so many different types of forms. So the parents may be out there right now and they bought their child a highlighter for school or a phone case or some type of backpack, and that is the vape. The vape is being disguised in that. So you're buying the children twice. And then, it's a big deal. Yeah, these companies in China are disguising the vapes in everyday children's things. So like a pencil case or, an iPhone holder, anything, you know. And so
really?
We're seeing a little bit of, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. I did a story on that just this week on WWL TV because, you know, parents are being hoodwinked into thinking that they're buying something for their child that actually is a vape. So the ability for children to escape because they're using either nicotine at the nicotine that you have in a vape is sometimes one pack is equal to the amount of nicotine in 35 packs of cigarettes. So either they're going to get that or they're going to get the marijuana vape. And like I said, none of these things are regulated and they can cause a problem. And I have seen more than one 12-year-old or 11-year-old that's vaping every day at school. And it's a real problem in our New Orleans and Metairie schools.
Well, let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. We come back talking to Dr. Corey Hebert, who is, of course, the Associate Professor of Pediatrics at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine, also WWL-TV's medical, doctor correspondent? What do you call yourself?
I'm a correspondent. They call me the medical correspondent. No, whatever works.
All right, we're talking about vaping, and that's interesting. You can go to WWLTV.com and find the story about how they're hiding vapes in highlighters and pencil cases and iPhone holders, things like that, where you don't even know that your kid has it, and they could be vaping. We'll continue when we come back. 720, traffic now, WWL. 7:25 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Dr. Corey Hebert, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. And surprisingly, and I just watched the piece that you did on Channel 4. I tried, but I got a lot of stuff going on here, Dr. Corey. I saw most of it. Now they're hiding vapes and highlighters and pencil cases and iPhone holders, and people are saying, well, how are the kids getting them? And I guess the kids are going in and buying them, or somebody's buying them for the kids, and the parents don't know about it. Accurate?
That is correct. But, you know, when you are a parent and your kid said, look, I want this highlighter for school, and you go on Amazon and you buy it, you bought the vape.
I got you. Okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's the problem.
Let's talk about popcorn lung.
Yes. So popcorn lung is something that we're seeing. And I guarantee you the law offices of Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe are going to be suing. You're going to hear this in 5 years from now. I just showed my age. Sorry about that. You're going to see.
No, but what's interesting is we talked about Monty Python. You made a Three Stooges reference just now. That's interesting.
There you go. Right. Now, they make me knee slap.
Me too. There you go. That's a guffaw. That's a full guffaw right there.
That's a guffaw. Well, you know, but I will say, you know, when you're looking at the 5-year term of people vaping, you're going to see a huge amount of popcorn lung. You're going to see a huge amount of toxins. Popcorn lung is something that you get from vaping. It's irreversible. It causes your lungs to actually – they call it popcorn lung not because your lungs look like popcorn. They do that because of the chemical that is released from the vape causes the same thing that they used to get when they would have these folks – at the factory that made popcorn, they inhale this type of chemical and it causes them to have irreversible lung damage. So that's coming with the vaping, as well as just the concept of you're going to have some other illnesses, diseases, cancers, because people are vaping so much. And I would be remiss if I did not mention that vaping was going down because of these nicotine patches. Have you ever heard of a nicotine patch called Zyn? Have you ever heard of this?
Not really, no.
Okay, so this is a big one. You can't go, and you're a golfer, and if you just pay attention when you're on the golf course, everyone out there has this little pack, and they put it in their mouth. It's like between their cheek and gum, like you used to put like Skoal and those types of things, and it's a nicotine pouch.
Oh, yes. Now I know what you're talking about. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know what it was named.
And that has, but the children are putting 3 and 4 of these things in their mouths, getting their nicotine rush, and that also is a big problem. People are trying to just they're trying to get rushes from things. They're trying to escape. They're trying to get these dopamine hits because these iPhones and cell phones, they are constantly giving you dopamine every time you, you know, see one of these little snippets, and it comes so quickly. So people are addicted to dopamine. So when you take nicotine or you take anything that's a stimulant like that, it gives you, it's fulfilling that dopamine that you're getting from being on your phone all day. And you've got to get these phones away from these children. They cannot have open access to phones because they're going to get addicted to the dopamine in their brain, and they're going to be watching porn. They're going to be talking to pervs going to play Roblox because that's an open access. So all of these things, the vaping, all of this, is a way for them to either escape from their harsh reality that they're not really prepared for what they need to do in life, or trying to get the dopamine that they need to cope with their dopamine addiction from their phones. And then this is being borne out in data at this point, and we'll be able to produce it and publish it in the next year or so. It's just a bad situation.
Here's the thing. I would remind you, you're under oath, and I do have the right to recall you in the future to talk about Zyn and nicotine and also about dopamine addiction. Doc, real quick, is there any way to tell if your kid is vaping?
You know, there's really no way to tell, except if you have to know your kid and you ask them, are you vaping? Really harsh. And then go through their stuff. Yeah. That's the only thing. And I hate to be this way. Oh, you know, you shouldn't invade your kids' privacy. Until you pay mortgage on my house, your child does not have privacy when it comes to me going through their stuff and seeing if they are doing something that's going to destroy them. I can't, you know, you have to go through their stuff. But there's no physical way for you to be able to know.
The only thing I would say, I'm no doctor, but the detective in me would say, instead of asking, are you vaping, I just casually say, so what's your favorite vape, or how often are you vaping, and see if they answer right.
Yes, that's a good trick. Yeah. That's a really good trick.
Well, it's a technique, Doc. It's not a trick. Thank you, Dr. Yes. Corey Hebert. Have a great weekend. Associate Professor of Pediatrics at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. Right now it's time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 7:47, 13 till 8. What happens when a hippie is forced to become an entrepreneur? I say that because I'm using the words of our next guest, Franziska Trautmann, who was quoted by Rich Collins in his article at NOLA.com about glass half full. Good morning, Franziska. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you doing?
I love your story. I really do, about glass half full. Tell me the story from beginning to where we are now.
Sure. So glass half full started, as we say, like most good ideas, over a bottle of wine. My co-founder, Max, and I were sharing a two-buck chuck in our college house while we were seniors at Tulane. Realized that that bottle would end up in a landfill because we didn't really have adequate glass recycling here in Louisiana, and decided to change that. We started a GoFundMe, started recycling glass in a backyard back in 2020. And now, 5 years later, we just opened up our 3-acre glass recycling facility in Chalmette, where we can process about 500,000 beer bottles in a day.
See, I think this is amazing, because what kind of capital investment are you talking about here? What kind of money have you invested, or do you have invested so far in this?
So the initial GoFundMe was for $10,000, mm-hmm. which is what got us started in 2020. But the recent facility we just built was more like a couple million dollars that was invested by a ton of incredible partners in the city.
So tell me what you do with, first, and the reason I ask that is you got people drinking a glass of wine from Trader Joe's. That's what two-buck chuck is, right?
Correct.
Okay. So you're drinking that, and you're looking at a glass bottle, and you're saying, I wonder what, huh? Yeah, it's just going to wind up in a landfill. So from that, you start a GoFundMe, then you get millions in capital investment at this Chalmette plant. Tell me what you guys do with the glass that you collect, and how people drop off glass, how you get the glass that is recycled, and what you do with it.
Yeah, so this Glass Half Full's kind of founding idea was, what if we could turn glass back into sand, which glass is made from sand, and use it in our coastal erosion crisis that we all know is here in Louisiana. And so that was the founding idea. And after years of research with funding also from the National Science Foundation, we've been able to do that and do projects. So that's one of the main uses of our recycled glass is sand for coastal restoration. But also at our new facility, we can also turn the glass into what's called cullet, which is the raw material that's used to make new bottles. So it goes basically sand to sand and then bottle to bottle as well at the new facility. And the three main ways we collect glass across Louisiana, but also Mississippi now, is free drop-offs where anyone can bring us their glass. So we have locations all over, especially the greater New Orleans region. And those are all listed on our website. And then we also have residential pickups where we'll pick up the glass right from your door. And then we also collect from the main source of glass, right? That's our bars, hotels, restaurants, casinos, all around town, Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama.
I like the story about the high school. I'm not going to mention it, but the kids dropping off mommy's wine bottles, mommy's calm down juice, right?
So, yes, it's actually more common than you'd think.
No, I don't doubt at all that it's common. So when it comes to property or land that you're creating, there are results from this, right? Land that you can stand on and plant vegetation on?
Yes. One of those is our islands in Bayou Bienvenue, so right on the shores of Bayou Bienvenue in Chalmette as well, where we've utilized our sand to create these small islands. And then, yes, exactly, be able to plant, you know, native grasses as well as cypress trees and other trees on that land.
So when it comes to how big this could get, how far this could go, what are you thinking? Because I know you said you are a hippie turned entrepreneur. If you were a hippie, I'm guessing you were thinking about tomorrow. Now that you're an entrepreneur, you're probably thinking 5-10 years down the line.
Yes, exactly. And for us, 5-10 years down the line, we hope that we're expanded throughout the Gulf South. We really see a huge lack of glass recycling in that area. You know, 70% of all glass in the U.S. ends up in landfills. So there's a huge, huge gap in access to glass recycling, but a lot of it is down here in the Gulf South. And then combined with the potential use of using it for coastal restoration, it just makes a lot of sense for us to expand into Florida and maybe over to Texas and just recycle as much glass as possible.
Nobody thought of this before? Is this a patented thing or not? I'm just curious.
So people actually had thought of this before. We learned this later, of course. Mm-hmm. We thought we had this idea, and then we learned that other people had this idea. But we're one of the first groups to actually do the research required to put it into action in terms of using it for coastal restoration.
Did you want to talk about some of the investors? I know Ms. Gail Benson is one of them, right?
Yes, we have partners with Benson Capital, which is the incredible Ms. Gail Benson, and she's been awesome. She's been a really great partner for us. I think it's very clear that she cares about the future of Louisiana and especially our coast as well. And so, you know, in her words, it just made sense for her to support us in this. We also have partners in the Miro Foundation out in St. Bernard, another incredible group of people who care deeply about the future of St. Bernard Parish and especially our coast. So we've been really lucky to have, you know, just great partners all across Louisiana supporting us in this from the beginning, from that GoFundMe, you know, all those people supporting us to now having people like Ms. Benson.
We only have 60 seconds left. Tell me the process. What happens? So a bottle, what do you do with a bottle from the time it you get it to when it becomes sand, I guess?
So it's all a completely automated process. So it goes into the hopper, it's crushed down, labels are separated, any caps, corks, anything non-glass is separated. And then optical sorters actually automatically can separate the glass by color as well, separate out any contaminants. And then the sand is pulverized, rounded. That's something people ask a lot. It's pulverized, it's rounded out, and then separated by size. And that's pretty much it. All the contaminants come out, all the labels, everything like that.
It's a lot different than plastic, right? Because plastic recycling can get kind of complicated, but with glass, not that difficult?
Correct, because glass is pretty much glass.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, plastic is not always just plastic,
right.
You know.
How can people find out more or donate or get involved if they want to, Francisca?
Yes, they can head to our website, glasshalffull.co.
Glasshalffull.co. Now, real quick, did you end your life more as a hippie or as an entrepreneur?
I think I'm liking being an entrepreneur for now.
It was more fun when you were a hippie, admit it. I'm just kidding. Congratulations, y'all. Do some great work. Good talking to you, Franziska Troutman, co-founder and CEO of Glass Half Full. 7:55, 5 till 8. Traffic now, WWL. 8:14, quickly to Mike Dettelier, WWL NFL analyst, co-host of Sports Talk. How you doing, Mike Dettelier?
I'm doing great, Tommy. How are you doing?
I am okay. I'm excited about the game on Sunday night. You got some Chargers connections there with Brandon Staley, with Kellen Moore going back to the Chargers in 2023. And I'm just wondering, what happened to these practices that were scheduled and canceled in what, late May, early June?
Yeah, for whatever reason, they couldn't have those practices with one another. They'd have probably done that more next week after the game, but... that's usually something that occurs, I guess, for whatever reason. It didn't work out between the two teams.
Tell me what you've noticed from training camp, and we'll start with quarterback.
I think if you had to pick now, it would be Spencer Rattler. But you still, you know, you only a quarter of the race done, so to speak. But I do suspect that Kellen Moore knows who he will start the season with. I really feel he knows that in his mind already. Who will give me the best chance to win early on? And that's why I think he'll go early on with Rattler. Eventually, the baton gets put in the hands of Tyler Shuck. But if it was today, I got no doubt he would go with Spencer Rattler.
You know what confuses me when it comes to figuring out who your guy is? You're not going to see a lot of defensive looks, different looks,
nope,
in preseason. And you can have either Tyler or the Ratlock go with the first offensive line. And while that is important, until you tee it up for real against the Cardinals, that's when the confusing looks start to come. So how hard is it to pick who your guy is? Because reading defense is a big part of it, right?
Yeah, it's the processing part of what goes on out on the field. And at first, it might look like you got man coverage. And from man coverage, they go to a zone. It's a real quick process. And talking to Drew Brees, and Drew has told me this in the past, but I brought it up to him last night when we had him on. He was like, man, that's what experience is all about. It's tough. You know, and we get people say, oh, they'll text in, well, Jaden Daniels did it. Okay. He's an outlier. Not everybody is going to be like Jaden Daniels or C.J. Stroud 2 years ago. Those guys are the outliers to come in here and play like they have been in the NFL. It is
rare. Yeah, if you can make that comparison, you also need to look at the people who tried to do it and failed miserably, right?
Yeah, and I tell this story at Manning Passing Academy every year. Peyton Manning talks to the 45 to 50 college starting quarterbacks that are there. And, you know, he gives them the long tail and about, hey, if you ever need me, I'm there. You can give me a call anytime during the season or whatever. And he said, but you need to do one thing for me. Break my record for most pass interceptions as a rookie. And that still gripes him. And you can tell he's not just saying that to say it for a few laughs. That really gripes. And who was more prepared to play in the NFL than Peyton Manning?
Mm-hmm.
And yet that record still holds today for Peyton. So, man, if you think it's easy, you know, because we had one texter, he said, if you can play in college, you can play in the NFL. Man, I can tell you a whole host of guys that could play in college football but couldn't play worth a lick in the NFL. It's a totally, totally different game. And, but, you know, I think bottom line is this. You didn't pick Tyler Shuck with the 40th overall pick in the draft for him to watch all season. You picked him to eventually become your guy. And somewhere down the line, he's going to get his opportunity to be the starting quarterback for this team. But if you ask me about game one today against Arizona, I would say it's Spencer Rattler.
The other thing is when it comes to comparing quarterbacks, Jaden Daniels was LSU's leading rusher, right? And he ran for a ton of yards last year. So that also takes some of the pressure off of the game when it comes to him passing. So if you're going to compare A to A, you got to make sure that you compare a guy with the same running ability as does Jayden Daniels, and I don't think Tyler Shuck has that, does he?
Oh, no. I mean,
I say that
listen, Tommy, that list is real short.
I say that tongue-in-cheek, but that's the point I'm making. You gotta compare apples to apples if you're going to do that.
Yeah, and you think about it, too. The guys last year that really started a lot of games and really had success, Jayden was a starting quarterback at Arizona State before he came to LSU, where he started for 2 years. Bo Nix, look all the games he started at Auburn and at Oregon. They had a lot more experience than what Tyler Shuck does as a starting quarterback. And, you know, Tyler had some injuries, and that's just part of the game sometimes. But, you know, for this football team, I think you want to kind of get a look because your investment really has been along your offensive line. And what you have, how quickly that can come together and gel as one unit, you want to see your depth there. But, man, the big question marks for me would be is at wide receiver and tight end, where you sort of know who your starters are, but who becomes the third and fourth or fifth receiver? Who is your backup tight end? And I think maybe some changes are going to occur along the defensive line, maybe more so than any other unit.
All right, let me take a break.
They brought in a lot of veterans.
We'll pick it up. When we come back, I also want to talk to you about something that I think is one of the more important factors when it comes to who's going to succeed, who's not going to succeed, and there's no way you can predict it. I'll explain when we return. 821 traffic now, WWL. Saints take on the Chargers, 11 o'clock on Sunday here on WWL. Saints take on the Chargers at 3:05. Our coverage starts at 11 o'clock. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Mike Dettillier, WWL NFL analyst, co-host of Sports Talk. Mike, I never bet total number of wins or losses because you don't have enough information at the time to make that bet. Because, as I said before the break, there is one thing that can determine whether a team is successful or not, just in terms of how it affects them, but how it affects the team they're playing and when they're playing them, and that would be...
You tell me, is it injuries?
You got it. That's exactly right. Because you never know, right?
Yeah, look, the Chargers lost Rashawn Slater for the season yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
He was given the biggest contract ever given to an offensive lineman last week. And he goes down to a season-ending knee injury. And you don't think that makes a difference? You might have to do some maneuvering across your offensive line, but it's not next man up.
Nope.
Okay, there's nobody on that roster that's even close to Rashawn Slater. And you proved that by giving him that type of money. When you made him the highest paid offensive lineman in the history of the NFL.
Is he related to Jackie Slater, the Rams? Or
no, he's not. No, okay. No, he went to Northwestern. I'll never forget. Zach Streif tells me, Mike, there's a freshman at Northwestern. You got to watch. And he told me Rashawn Slater. Okay. And I watched him the first couple games of the season when he played. And I'm like, this guy looks like a fifth-year senior. I mean, he was sort of special. He never played as a junior. If you remember, that was the COVID year in 2020, and the Big Ten sort of dragged their feet. And he just decided, you know what, man, if you're not making a decision, then I'm just going to start training for the NFL. And that's exactly what he did. Never played as a junior. But, man, he is a really good football player. Terrific, terrific player.
So that's
a big loss for the Chargers.
And when it comes to injuries, that's why before you count the Saints out or in, it depends on how they handle the injury or how the injury bug bites them and how the injury bug bites their opponents. And it doesn't have to be a season-ending thing. It can be who you play that week if they got a tweaked hamstring, this, that, the other thing, right?
Okay, think about the first two games last year for the Saints.
Mm-hmm.
Before the injuries really started to hit. Look at how they just sort of steamrolled over the Panthers and the Cowboys. And they went toe-to-toe with the Eagles in game three.
Mm-hmm.
It took a kind of a blotch coverage for them to lose that game against the Eagles.
The Super
but
Bowl
think
champions.
About,
the eventual
yeah,
Super Bowl champions. Yeah.
Think about how that season went. The first three games and what you saw afterwards. And a lot of that, too, on offense, especially Eric McCoy at center. Once he went down, this team, man, it fell down like a deck of cards.
I'm just saying, don't rule anything out. Don't rule anything in for the season because you never know how it's going to turn out, right? You got to be a little bit lucky with injuries. You know what would be interesting? Look at a study. I don't know how you could ever prove this and see what role injuries played in terms of throughout the season with teams playing against other teams who had injuries at this position. There's no way you could ever really figure that out, could you?
No, that would be real tough. I do know the positions that get injured more is tackles, offensive guard, offensive tackles, offensive guard, centers. Those three, they get hurt more than any other position in college or pro football.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate your time. We'll be listening for you this afternoon and on Sunday and everything else. Mike Dettelier, WWL NFL analyst, co-host of Sports Talk. We'll take a break, come back, talk about the Regional Transit Authority and hurricane preparedness. Right now, though, time for WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, Friday morning, August 8th, heading into the peak of hurricane season. And Lona Hankins joins us now, CEO of the Regional Transit Authority. Talk about some hurricane preparedness and other things. How you doing, Lona?
Good morning. How are you?
It's okay to call you Lona and not Ms. Hankins or CEO Hankins or anything like that.
Lona's perfect.
Let's talk about the RTA, because I think a lot of people know of it, but they don't really know what you are or what you do.
So we are the Regional Transit Authority, and we operate the buses, the streetcars, the ferries, and paratransit. We our service area includes parts of Jefferson Parish and parts of St. Bernard Parish and all of New Orleans.
So it's not just Orleans Parish.
Right. So we provide transportation down into Nunez Community College and into Elmwood. Like we really wanted to target some of the major job centers or education centers or hospitals to make sure that our region and our community is served well.
What is ridership like, Lona?
Our bus ridership is almost as high as it was in 2017. And our streetcar ridership is not quite as robust as it has been, partially because of a lot of construction work that it has occurred over the last year or so on our streetcar lines.
Tell me, for people that perhaps, and I'm just going to address the elephant in the room, that would maybe like to take mass transportation but will be hesitant to do so, tell me about the experience they can have if they decide to take one of the RTA buses.
Well, I'm going to encourage your audience, listening audience, to ride public transit. They can download the LePass app. They can buy their fare right there on the LePass app. Our app helps them navigate our system and helps them know where the buses are at any given time. Many locals not only use the bus to get to work or the streetcar to get to work, they also use it for entertainment. So it's cheaper than the Uber or Lyft. And if you want to party a bit, there's some lines that can get you to and from the parties and safely back. Even if you think about like football games and the parking headache. You can download that app, and from your neighborhood, just almost like Google Maps, from your neighborhood, you can figure out how to get to the Saints game or the Pelicans game and get back home safely.
So with the app, you don't have to like lean into the street to see if the bus is coming. You can check to see where the bus is coming, like because of some kind of global positioning thing or something.
Absolutely.
Tell me what you would like
you
people.
Can watch.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You can watch the buses kind of move down the street just like you would on the Lyft app.
So the LePass, how do you get that?
You go to your app store, whether it's you have an Android phone or an iPhone, and it's right there on the app store, or you can go to the RTA's website, and it'll link you there. Our website is NORTA.com.
All right, let me take a break here. We'll talk about hurricane preparedness when we come back. 504-260-1870. If you ride public transit, I'd love to hear from you. That's the Oakland Art Jeweler talk and text line. No texting and driving. But if you're riding public transit, you can text because somebody else is driving, and you're just sitting there in a bus listening to us through your phone and having a good old time. 504-260-1870. Let me know if you use public transit or what you would like Lona Hankins to do, or what problems you have, or how the system's working or not. I'd love to hear from you. 8:49, minute early. Let's check traffic now on WWL. 8:54, 6 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Lona Hankins, CEO of the Regional Transit Authority. Somebody texted in, said, LaPass, the app for using RTA, pleasantly surprised me when I first used it. Somebody else said, the RTA has changed so much, I now use nothing but buses to get to and from work, and it's saving me a ton of money. So apparently y'all are doing something right, Lona.
We are in the always continuous improvement efforts.
Tell me about Tell me about hurricane season and what you would like people to know.
Yes. So what? First and foremost, we support the city in its plan to evacuate the city when called. So what I want your listening audience to know is that when the mayor and the authorities say mandatory evacuation, all they need to do is grab a small bag. And then go to their nearest bus stop. And then we will pick them up from their nearest bus stop, get them to our transfer points, and then get them to the Smoothie King or the city's evacuation point. I also want to encourage those folks with medical needs to contact 311 and register with the city there, and also sign up for NOLA Ready. Text NOLA Ready to 77295 so that they can get all of the messages. During an emergency, we try to use the city's unified NOLA Ready platform to get our messages out, whether or not transit will be disabled or if we're returning to service. So it's important that we support the city in this effort and that we speak with one voice. So NOLA Ready is that platform.
Somebody texted in about cash if you're riding a bus. Do you have to have the app, or do you need exact change, or how does that work?
We do take exact change, and I think the fare is like $1.25.
Mm-hmm. Bills, or does it have to be coins?
It can be both.
Okay. And any credit card option?
Not yet.
Okay. But
working on it.
Stay
We're
tuned.
Working on it.
Stay tuned, right?
Yes.
And somebody else texted in about any plans to improve, not improve, but to increase the amount of lines that you have or the routes and those kind of things. And how do you go about determining what are the most effective or most needed routes?
So let's start with the data. We collect data at every stop of the number of riders that are onboarding our stops.
Okay.
Or onboarding our buses. And we then use that data multiple times a year. Three times a year, we adjust our schedules to provide improvement on reliability. This past June, we shifted our schedules because one of the things we noticed was we were hitting those early morning pullouts and getting people to work on time or better. But it was in the evenings when they were coming home, that evening rush hour, we were missing it. And so we shifted some of our late night schedules in order to, where our riders were less, where we had less riders to improve the service between the rush hour. We are about to launch a deep look at our service on the West Bank. And we'll be hosting several community outreach meetings over the next series of weeks, starting Thursday, August the 14th from 4:30 to 6:30 at the Algiers Regional Library, trying to hold listening sessions so that not only as we want to hear what we think we know what the challenges are from the data, but we want to hear from people what the challenges are so that we can start to address the challenges and then lay out a plan, bring it back to the community, see what their reaction is, and then probably maybe next May, actually implement that plan.
Somebody texted about senior bus fare, only 40 cents. Is that accurate or not?
That's accurate.
And you got to be.
A deal.
How are you defining senior?
It says 65.
Oh, well, I'd have to wait a while for that. But either way, it's good. Thank you for your time, Lona. I appreciate it. I tell you what, I live kind of far out in Belchase, but if I could walk out to my street, get on a bus, and get a ride downtown and then back home, that would give me 2 hours extra a day to work that I wouldn't have to drive.
Well, Well, maybe one day soon you'll be able to drive to Algiers, park, and then hop on our bus rapid transit line.
That might not be bad. That might be a great idea. Thank you, Lona. Work on it for me, would you?
You're welcome.
Thank you. All right,
I'm
Lona.
I'm working on it.
Do it. Lona Hankin, CEO of the Regional Transit Authority. We'll take a break when we come back. I've decided to call it Happy Hour with Ian McNulty, who covers food and dining culture for the Times-Picayune New Orleans Advocate. It's Happy Hour coming up between 9 and 10. And if you have any questions about where to eat, where to drink, where you have been eating or drinking, and you got a comment to make about it, text them in, 504-260-1870. We'll hear what Ian has to say when we come back on WWL. Best time of the week. I like to call it Happy Hour. At least I just began calling it that. Ian McNulty joins us, who covers food and dining culture for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate. How you doing, Ian McNulty?
Great to be back with you, Tommy. Raring to go for the weekend.
Yeah, that's why we get you started with Happy Hour, huh?
That's right. Yeah, well, coffee over here for now, but, you know, yeah. The gears will shift. I'm happy to be with you.
There you go. So it's Happy Hour. Let's talk about where you've been eating and where you've been drinking, and I'll ask people to text in, as I have before, 504-260-1870. That's the Okanor Jewelers Talk and Text Line. No texting and driving ever. But if you got any questions about restaurants, where places you'd like to try, you're going to try places, things you'd like to order, et cetera. So tell me about your experience, Ian. What have you been doing?
So I'm going to start with a happy hour, Tommy. I've been all over the map lately. This is, you know, summertime. I really have been trying to just kind of lean into it, you know, like what you and I have been talking about all summer is like, just go out, find some fun, throw some support to some places while we have, you know, we have campus to ourselves before all the tourists come back. I mean, the students aren't even back to college yet. And you can tell, but, you know, this wonderful city built for hospitality is all ours right now, still for a little bit. So Happy Hour is, you know, it's a movable feast, isn't it? It's not necessarily just an hour, and sometimes it's not where you expect it to be. I turned up to a place called Barrel Proof on Monday. This is a Monday, two hence. And this is a bar in the Lower Garden District. It's a tavern.
Monday two hence. What the hell does that mean?
Two Mondays ago.
Oh, really? Is that an Irish expression or what?
Or backwards, yeah. A reverse hence. Strike that. Reverse it. Two weeks ago, Tommy.
You teach me some stuff, man. I'm telling you. So 2 weeks hence, 2 weeks ago, you reading when? Not last Monday, but the Monday before.
Okay, hence means forward, I misspoke. So let's just go back in time 2 weeks to Barrel Proof, which is in Lower Garden District, Magazine Street. Groovy little bar. Whiskey is the jam there. Has a world-beating whiskey list and a great old-fashioned. One of your night's topics.
Yeah, now you're talking. They got my attention.
They have a happy hour or the old-fashioned. The house old-fashioned is on special. We happened to be going there on a Monday, like I said, and discovered that in the summertime, it's happy hour all night, which is nice. But really, we were there to eat. They have a pop-up there called Matchbook Kitchen, and it's one of those pop-ups that's really a residency. You know, it's not just like randomly popping up or just setting up on the sidewalk. They take over the kitchen on a regular schedule, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. And it's the kind of pop-up I love because it's not just doing kind of, you know, the food you would find anywhere and just happens to be under your nose at a bar, which is handy enough. It's doing food that you would go seek out anywhere. So in this case, it's a very unique take on Asian food that's creative without being out of bounds. It's fun. It's fresh. If you're missing MoFo, which sadly closed in the spring, it's not exactly the same, but it kind of dials into some of the same ideas. Anyway, it's called Matchbook Kitchen. We went and we started ordering some things and then learned happy hour goes all night. So what did we do, Tommy? We kind of made a night of it. We ate through a lot of the menu. This is all paper plate casual food, but it's really good.
Like, tell me again where that was.
Matchbook Kitchen is the name of the kitchen, and they run out of Barrel Proof Bar in the Lower Garden District, which is, again, known for its whiskey and especially for its old-fashioned. So I would circle that for a Monday. They're doing that through the end of the summer, so through the end of August for practical purposes. But that happy hour continues all the time, you know, on their regular happy hour schedule.
The 1201 Magazine, right, for people that are trying to find a place? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's right, Barrel Proof on Magazine, just past the overpass. Now, let's vault around to a whole different part of town. Dr. Jones is a casual hole in the wall kind of place that you and I have talked about when they first opened earlier in this year. And I kind of described it as a chef run diner because it seemed primarily a lunch spot with dishes that just looked at really interesting, barbecue shrimp, a gumbo, but were done with such a high level of technique and these surprising twists. You could tell there were like fine dining chefs who had like, you know, were just doing their own thing in their own joint without all the bells and whistles of fine dining, but just really good, flavorful food. That is still the case. However, they've turned it into a different gear. Dr. Jones has expanded the schedule to be more, to still do lunch, but also expanded to dinner. And so when we went by recently, this group of people had caught on to it and basically had turned it into their own dining club for the night. And I loved seeing it because this is destination-worthy food in a spot that you really might not expect. This is on Vets in Metairie. Got a halfway between Dorniak's and Martin Wine Cellar for two very wine-specific reference points because Dr. Jones is BYOB, so, you know, bring a bottle from home or stop at one of those places if you forget until you're halfway there. And it's, Tommy, it's tiny. I mean, it really is. It's probably six seats at a diner counter and maybe five, six tables can probably fit, oh, I don't know, you know, 22, 24 people at any given time. Open kitchen. It really does kind of still have the contours of a diner, but the dishes that they were producing there, definitely white tablecloth worthy, but affordable, no-nonsense, BYOB, just really beautiful, interesting, original food at good prices right there in a blink and you miss it strip mall in Metairie, and a delight to rediscover.
Boy, blink and you miss it is right, huh? I'm looking at it now on Google Maps, and you really got to be looking to find this place.
Yeah, that's right. It was once Yakuza House, the original location for Yakuza House, the wonderful sushi restaurant that later moved to much bigger digs. And people with a long memory for po' boys, I know they're out there, will remember it as the old Giovanni's po' boys with that wonderful look. Crawfish sausage po' boy that they used to do. I mean, that is, we're going back pre-Katrina at that point. But, you know, memory is long for certain picture points. Tommy, another new one that checked out just this week, I went when they first opened back in April, and I hadn't been for a while until just this week, and I'm really glad I did. It's down in the Warehouse District, and it's called Le Moyne Bistro. Le Moyne, like the, you know, the founder of New Orleans. And here's another very familiar address. For two decades, it was Tommy's Cuisine. And right next door was Tommy's Wine Bar, a lounge that later became something called Nosh. This is right on Chapultepec Street by Emeralds in the Warehouse District. And this is the latest from a group of guys, young chefs that all came out of the fine dining scene, a couple of them from the Link Restaurant Group, which is a very reliable incubator of local
talent. I knew you were going to say that. I swear to goodness, I knew you were going to say the Link Group, because that's like a coaching tree, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, in the same way that we talk about Commander's Palace, like just trace the family tree of that. Like the Link Group with, like, you know, Herb St. Pesh, Koshan, Gianna, Koshan Butcher, you know, La Boulangerie. Their just their system, their style, the leadership there, the standards. You can see when people sort of graduate from there and want to start their own restaurants, which is how it works in the restaurant business. That has planted like great concepts all around town. Castera, Osteria Lupo, and now Brutto Americano. That is another good example of two guys who came out of there to do their own thing and created some really great restaurants. Aviva, a really new one down in the Marigny, at the former Franklin restaurant. I mean, the list goes on and on. Company Burger on Ferret Street. You know, they're not sticking to just fine dieting. They're really planting different concepts around town, these chefs and restaurant minds that have come through that group. But the one these guys I'm talking about, they started 2 years ago with a place called Plates, which is in the Cotton Mill Building, which is a huge restaurant that focuses mainly on small plates. Has a banging happy hour, too, by the way, until like 7 o'clock. So it's one of those happy hours you can actually get to if you, you know, leave work at 5:30. And they have a beautiful bar, small plates, real fun, in the Cotton Mill Building. That's called Plates. And then they surprised me last year by tripling down and opening two restaurants right around the corner. That would be at the former Tommy's and Tommy's Wine Bar. So that is respectively now Le Moyne Bistro, which is the upscale one, and then Maria's Wine and Oyster Bar, which is the more casual one in the former, well, in the wine bar space. And they connect. They share a door.
Yeah, next door, I was going to say, right?
Yeah, you're right. You can go walk from one to the other without getting any raindrops or, you know, paparazzi chasing you around, however that your situation may be. But Le Moyne Bistro was the real glow up this week. It's French, and it's what I love about it, Tommy, is that it's not French with a twist. It's not French with a whole bunch of Nola Creole thrown at you, which I love. I love all that. But sometimes you just want it to be what it is. And this was a transporting meal to France. For the duration of the meal, we could close our eyes and think, yes, as I'm eating this pâté campagne with the spicy mustard and cutting into this crusty bread with cultured butter and spooning this this really precisely chopped beef tartare with a little horseradish, as I eat this tuna nichois salad, which was just perfect for the hot weather, and as I sip this Melon de Bourguignon wine from Loire, I am in France, as long as this spell will last. It's a beautiful room. It's an upscale restaurant for sure, but they're one of the many restaurants doing a culinary menu for the month of August. So it's a really nice introductory offer. And their culinary menu is very good. It has a few of the dishes I just mentioned, actually, and it has dishes that you want to try. It's not just like the sort of, you know, dogs in the menu or something they drew up just to say they have a culinary menu. It really is an appealing three-course, $55 culinary menu for a good introduction. Although when my running partner and I sat down to this one, we took a look at the main menu, took a look at the specials, and decided we were going to give it a bigger go. And I'm glad we did. If you'll stick with me, I'll post some photos.
Nola.com's paying for it anyway. Why not, right?
Yes, sir. And I actually had something on the specials list that, you know, you learn something new every day, Tommy. Mm-hmm. The specials came out, and there was this one dish called Jimmy Nardello Peppers. Mm-hmm. I thought, what the heck is this? Who's Jimmy? Mm-hmm. Is this the local farmer? You know, sometimes restaurants will name check P&J Oysters or, you know, wherever they had they're sourcing their produce from. And no, it turns out this is a type of pepper, long, narrow, red, sweet, but with a little trickle of heat to it. One of those garden fresh, taste like summer kind of dishes, crinkled up on the grill, served with a little tomato vinaigrette. It was excellent. Again, another one of those dishes. You just want to sip a glass of wine, close your eyes, and think, I'm drifting away to somewhere where it's not New Orleans summer. But that's the power of all these portals that our local restaurants give us. You can just step in to their circle of hospitality and float off for a little bit with a nice meal.
Let's take a quick break. We've already talked about Matchbook Kitchen in the barrel. I can't read my own name in writing.
Barrel Proof, that's right.
Barrel Proof Bar, 1201 Magazine. Dr. Jones, 325 Vets. That's between Popeyes and CVS. And Le Moyne right?
Yep, that's right.
Le Moyne Bistro, 746 Chapatoulas. That's where Tommy's used to be, and that's the way to give directions about that. All right, so we'll pick it up. We come back, 504-260-1870. Questions are pouring in for Ian McNulty. We're talking eating and drinking. It's happy hour, and we learned some stuff. I'll tell you who Le Moyne was when we return on WWL. 9:30 here, happy hour as we talk to Ian McNulty, who covers food and dining culture for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate. The most prominent members of the Le Moyne family include Pierre Le Moyne d'Iberville, who founded the Louisiana colony and the first European settlement in Mississippi, and Jean-Baptiste Le Moyne de Bienville, known as the father of Louisiana and founder of New Orleans. How about that stuff? Ian McNulty teaches us some stuff, man. If you have any questions or comments about eating or drinking, 504-260-1870. Somebody texted in and said, Jimmy Nardello is a friend of ours, a made guy, be nice. I don't know what that means. Somebody else texted in and said, I went to, and I'm not going to read the name of the place because I don't think it would be fair, blank, and it was terribly overpriced, but I was able to enjoy it because the boss was paying for it. Which is an interesting comment, I guess. Somebody else wants to know about tomorrow, specifically breakfast, around 11 o'clock, taking part in the Red Dress Run activities, a place for four or five people to eat breakfast, not running in the race, though, because I don't think you want to go out on a hot summer morning after eating brunch and run any distance at all. But French Quarter recommendations, four or five people for brunch on tomorrow morning, Ian, and also I got to thinking about that and dress codes for restaurants. For example, I don't know what it is at Galatoire's, but tomorrow, can you get in wearing a red dress if you're a guy?
Okay, I'm going to – wow, there's a lot to unravel.
There is a lot to unpack, so go ahead. Put the suitcase up on the bed and have at it.
Okay, I'm going to take that in reverse order. Right. First of all, yes, tomorrow is Red Dress Run, which has turned into one of those giant summer melees. The ways that, you know, the New Orleanians entertain themselves, when we've got campus to ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. Who says it's slow in summer? It's really hot, but not necessarily slow in the social calendar. So, yeah, the French Quarter will be filled with people. And the request for breakfast or brunch, I assume, is a post-run meal.
No, they're saying before. They said they're okay, not running, but around 11 o'clock. I don't know when the race is. I'm just going
sure. Well, plenty of people are running or walking or meandering or crawling or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, for those who don't know, it's basically a giant kind of morning drinking sort of, you know, running of the bulls, but in guys and gals do in red dresses and increasingly just sort of red garments. But the ones who are doing it right are wearing red dresses. And it's an early start. It's an undisclosed route, but we know it starts at Armstrong Park on North Rampart Street, and the quarter and adjacent neighborhoods will be filled, and you need to fill up too. So if you're down in the quarter, you know, for this time frame, for this, you know, you've done this, it's post run. Yeah, you need to eat. You need to be kind to yourself. You're wearing red dresses. Can you get into Galatoire's? Yes, you can. Jackets. Required has definitely become more jackets recommended, or jackets if you know what you're doing. But then there's always a caveat for it in New Orleans of you're wearing a costume. You know, I mean, Galatoire's is a place that has full on people in theatrical costumes for Mardi Gras, for almost at Thanksgiving, but I could believe it at Galatoire's, at Halloween. So, you know, it's one of those things where New Orleans institutions are institutions, and they do and should uphold standards, but those are very bendable to New Orleans culture, too. And the general idea of dress codes is, yeah, you should. Like, you know, if you're going to Antoine's, if you're going to Galatoire's, Arnaud's, I can think of maybe a handful of others. Yeah, you know, wear a jacket if you're a guy. Dress up if you're a gal. But at the same time, it's not the days when the maitre d' will hold up his nose and, you know, bar your entry. You know, if you're a tech bro who's coming in and you're going to drop $5,000 on a bottle of wine and you just have to be wearing a $500 pair of jeans and a, you know, $300 t-shirt, they're going to let you in. Yeah. They're going to let you in. They're going to welcome you with open arms.
That's interesting as you say that, as opposed to a $99 suit that travels all over you like a Michelin tire.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it's what these places are built for, you know. I believe you should take them on their own terms.
So
but,
places, yeah. Specific places for this person?
Yeah. Cultural caveat is that, you know, when it's a holiday like this or a celebration, all bets are off. Yeah. Down in the French Quarter, Felipe's is built for this kind of thing. It's quick serve Mexican food with some drinks in the bar. It's good for people rolling in when they, you know, they need to eat. Napoleon House, if you want to go a little more classic, have a big muffalata in front of you. Can a muffalata be breakfast? Yes, it can. A little more conventional breakfast, Stanley on Jackson Square, kind of the old-fashioned diner. Just don't mess around. Go to Verde Mart and get one of those ginormous po'boys. It's down in the, you know, the quieter end of the quarter there, late-night convenience store deli. Good for things like this. If you're full on making a day of it, like we're doing the Red Dress Run and we're actually going to make a reservation tonight to go out tomorrow, try Sylvain down also near Jackson Square. Fantastic place. Or something like Tableau. Don't let the huge construction going on around Jackson Square right now scare you off. Those restaurants are open and we're happy to see your business. So if you want to do sort of a bigger thing where you're planning this out, not just rolling in after the Red Dress Run with a, you know, half-finished Go Cup in one hand and an empty belly growling at you. If you want to plan out your adventure tomorrow, hit up places like that.
So are you wearing a red dress? I'm just wondering if you take part in it.
No, I've done it in the past, but it's one of those things that I prefer to let other people enjoy.
I was just wondering what size you would be. I'm guessing about a 13, maybe a 16.
Extra medium.
Oh, extra medium. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Here we go. Somebody wants to know about good places in St. Bernard to eat.
Well, you've got your classics, of course. You know, you say St. Bernard, everyone's going to automatically think Rocky and Carlos, ladies invited and respected. But there's a lot more happening in St. Bernard Parish now than just the classics. This one is kind of a modern classic in my book, Mimi's Bar and Grill. It's been around for a while, but it's in a new era now. We talked earlier about chefs coming out of Donald Link's group and doing different things around town. Mimi's now is in the hands of a group of guys who came out of Emerald. And during the pandemic, when the restaurants were shut down, they started their own catering company where they do upscale kind of chef tasting menu style dinners in private homes. And lo and behold, one of them took over Mimi's. He's a St. Bernard guy. He grew up in Chalmette, went off to the world of fine dining, came full circle and took over Mimi's Bar and Grill. And it's not, upscale Emeralds kind of thing now, but it is definitely the upscale restaurant for St. Bernard Parish. Good steaks, good oyster bar, nice wine list. Every once in a while, they'll put on a special wine dinner there that'll knock your socks off. And it's not a thing of like, whoa, they're doing this in St. Bernard. But kind of it is. They're doing things in the parish that no one else is doing. But just day in and day out, this is the place for your business lunch, for your date night out with your honey. It's worth a trip all on its own. It's got its own character. If you like oysters, they do char-grilled oysters there several different ways. It's one called Bangkok style. It's got like a Southeast Asian hot sauce on it. Terrific place. Also in St. Bernard, I can't think of the parish these days without thinking of Secret Thai. We've talked about it before. It's a traditional Thai restaurant that just goes big on portions and really big on spice if you ask them to or if you dare. This has like a spice rating chart of 1 to 5. And unless you have Thai parents, maybe grandparents, you're going to be highly questioned if you go over 1.5, say. And I've been there, and it's as hot as I ever want food to be at the 1.5 rating. But it's a great bargain. You're always going to have leftovers. The portions are huge. The prices are good, and it's BYOB, that Secret Thai.
We'll take a break. Pick it up. We come back with Ian McNulty. You referred to the Red Restaurant as a melee. Is that what you said? I don't mean to parse words, but would you say it's that or more of a shindig?
It depends what part of the morning you're in, I think.
You're the writer. You're the writer. I'm just asking.
It could start as a shindig and devolve into a melee.
Soiree, perhaps?
Yeah, it could be a soiree. It could evolve right back up to a soiree. You know, it's a wave diagram of the mood when you're off one of these morning beer-soaked crawls, isn't it?
All right, 9:40, 20 till 10, more with Ian McNulty when we come back. Somebody wants to know, Ian, I'll give you this. You can do some homework while we're on a break. I have a group of retirees. Can you recommend restaurants that are receptive to separate bills? I normally have 15 to 20 retirees who attend, so you can work on that. And right now, we'll look at traffic on WWL. All right, 9:46, 14 till 10. Never enough time with Ian McNulty. Happy hour. He covers food and dining culture for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate, and we love talking about it here on Friday morning. So, Ian, before we went to break, we have somebody that has a group of retirees, and they're looking for a restaurant that I guess doesn't mind receptive to separate bills, 15 to 20 people. Thoughts?
I think what the caller is really looking for is a luncheon, a banquet. You know, when you go to these things, these business meetings, they're set up for it, and everyone gets their bill, and it's no problem. If you can't just roll, just please don't do this. Don't roll into a restaurant and say, "Oh, we've got 20 people, and we'd all like separate bills." And it's just for a conventional restaurant set up for normal service, you're not setting yourself up for success. So it's the kind of thing you'll find a restaurant that specializes in this kind of thing, that knows you're coming, that will probably have a set menu. Like Ralph's in the Park comes to mind. Like restaurants that kind of do this day in and day out, and call them in advance and set it up specifically with that. Or if not, if you're looking for something, just, hey, is this us and the guys going out, casual lunch, we're all getting together, this is the way we roll. a place where you're ordering at the counter, frankly, because you automatically have a separate check. You control your own destiny and your own timeline with that. Go to Martin's Wine Cellar, either one of them, and you're a group of retirees. I promise you won't be the oldest people there either. choose your battles. And that's trying to dissuade you from doing this, but make a little preparation and find what you're really looking for. The terminology is you're coming in with a luncheon group for a small banquet, and you would like a large table with separate checks. And, you know, with that information, they can probably take care of you. Just back to Red Dress Run for a second.
Yeah.
I just remember some more good casual eats in the quarter that I think would really fit.
For the tomfoolery that's going on?
Yes, all the descriptors of it. Killer Po' Boys. That's another great one. Super casual, but interesting. Good food, hearty, fill you up. And Will in the Way for just a little more, not upscale, but a little nicer. But a killer burger, great modern tavern food. And just, you know, right there in the heart of the quarter, right off of, that one's on Toulouse Street, right off of Bourbon. Just a couple more of your spots to fill up.
You know, as you talk about separate checks and so forth, and a person had texted in. Anecdotally, I was having a conversation with somebody the other day that said they met some friends toward the end of the meal, midway to the end of the meal, and it was like an $800 tab. And they asked, he was asked if he wanted anything. He said, "No, I'm fine." And he said he wouldn't even drink water because he didn't want any part of that bill at all when it comes to paying for it. So generally speaking, from the restaurateur's side of it, from the diner's side of it, what's the best way to handle splitting up those kind of things? You do this for a living, so you should know.
Oh, yeah. Well, it depends on who you're rolling with, you know. I mean, I have groups of friends who, a heavy bill lands on the table. Somebody wants that. They want the points. They want the airline points. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he or she will drop a card on it, and we'll all Venmo them the share. I mean, the way that we roll, it's usually like, we're not saying, "Oh, well, you had the $30 entree, I had the $24 entree, so you carry the two,
right.
Then we're our tax, or you got bacon on your burger? That was a $2 upcharge. Mm-hmm. I don't think we should split it." Just, you know, the people that I roll with, fortunately, we you know, it's just, we're all in this together, we're splitting stuff up. And hopefully these are people that are, you know, not throwing you under the bus. Like, the expectation is not, everyone's having iced tea, but you ordered a $120 bottle of Burgundy, you know.
Right.
Don't be that. You know, it's social dining requires a certain etiquette and approach anyway. But, you know, yeah, generally, you know, a restaurant is not going to have a problem with four credit cards is sort of reasonable. After that, it's, you know, you make arrangements within your group, you know. Cash is still king at some places. I mean, I know that's kind of fading. But, you know, we used to call them yuppie food stamps, man. You know, the $20 bills. You used to go out to a restaurant and you go to the ATM and everyone would have a bunch of $20 bills and you got to split them up that way. I guess those would be 100 these days. But you take my point.
Yeah, 20 ain't what it used to be.
Yeah, I think the payment apps like Venmo, PayPal, whatever, are really helpful for that. And like, sometimes, I mean, I have friends, we go out, we split the bill. They get the next one. We get this one. You know, that's kind of how it rolls sometimes. But, you know, it's different with the dynamic of your group, how many people you're out with. Is it a business thing? Is it purely social? Do you owe Jimmy Nardello for some past
transgressions?
Yeah, for it, you know, maybe you're buying them two lobsters to take home, like the old-fashioned tax assessors, you know.
I used to have a guy, somebody that was, anyway, it's a family thing, and this person, every time it came time to pay the bill, and, you know, it's like, I'm like you. It's like, I'm not going to split this up. I got this time. You get it next time. But it was like he'd take his wallet out and it was, blow the cobwebs off of it. A little slow to pay. Yes, exactly. Somebody mentioned Crave in Miro about St. Bernard dining. Thoughts?
Yes, that's another one of the newer school kind of places. You know, it's, not, you know, this is not avant-garde cuisine, but it's a different change of pace from your old mom and them kind of places, you know.
But is it real cooking or is it like, you know, Cisco stuff?
No,
nothing against
yeah.
Cisco, I'm just saying, you know.
But, well, no, it's real cooking, and the Cisco truck travels far and wide, let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, not, it does, and I'm not...
It's, is what you do with it.
I'm not knocking them. I'm not saying that. And sometimes it can be a starting point. It can be like, you know, you get a, you know, a bag of gumbo, you throw it in a pot, and you boil it, and then you open the bag, and you put it on the plate, and then maybe from there you fool with it a little bit, right, and dress it up.
Yeah, at fancier places, they call that sous vide.
What's that?
I said at fancier places, they call that sous vide.
There you go. Do they really or not?
Well, it's the same theory, in fact. No, not really. If I'm joking.
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't know. I thought it might be like a Donnybrook, which brings us back to where we were before. Ian, it's always a pleasure to talk to you and mess around and have some fun on a Friday. Give me one dining recommendation this week for people to try if perhaps they've not tried it before. They're looking for a new place.
Station 6 in Bucktown. Went recently. It was just incredible. It's casual, but with fine dining cred. I'll put it that way. It's your casual restaurant with fine dining cred. And you know, if you're out about the French Quarter, this is a place that is sadly closing in a few weeks. Mm. Effervescence. It's closing because the owner is retiring and something new is going to come in there. We don't know what yet. But this is a beautiful restaurant and bar, really a lounge, but a high end champagne house.
Thanks, Ian. And, gotta run. Appreciate it as always. Thank you, sir. You bet. And matter of fact, Station 6 is right where a water spout kind of crossed the foot of the causeway. Pete Malone tweeting a picture of it. I retweeted it. You can follow me at TTuckerWWL, and you can see it. 9:55, we'll find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.